Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week marks 3 years since an Enbridge energy pipeline ruptured near Marshall, spilling some 800,000 gallons of tar sands oil into the Kalamazoo River. On today's program, we get an update on cleanup efforts and find out what still needs to be done. And then we hear from Michigan storyteller Allison Downey, who brings us the voices of the workers at a recent summer carnival. But first, eventually, Detroit's bankruptcy filing will be over. Eventually, emergency manager Kevin Orr will no longer be in charge of Detroit finances. When those things happen, Detroit goes back to being run by its city government, by a mayor and city council. Daniel Howes, columnist at the Detroit News, focused on this future in his column yesterday in the news. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm good. I was real intrigued with your column looking into the future. And tell us why and what does it mean that Kevin Orr is looking at this future city government? Should this be within his role as EM?
He does have the role to, or the ability to look at, or propose at least, structural changes that could help with governance. He can't do it unilaterally, is my understanding. So what he's doing right now, even as he's prosecuting, trying to prosecute this bankruptcy in bankruptcy court, he's reaching out to experts in governance and the like for essentially study and recommendations that he could put forth to a city council, or potentially they could propose to be put forth before the voters to change the charter in ways that could help the city be more efficient, to act more speedily, to reform things. As we saw in the last year or so, the charter has been a barrier to reform in several cases, and they recognize that. And I think this is part of a broader push to not only do a short-term restructuring, but make sure that there are the reforms in place that would enable the political leadership down the road to manage the city more effectively.
So it's bringing in fresh eyes.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, they're reaching out to the Ford Foundation. There's a new institute at NYU for the study of cities and urban environments that has offered and actually came to the city of Detroit and said, we would like to help you do this and make some recommendations. This is in the early stages, and clearly this is not his top priority. He's got other things, including a hearing before Judge Rhodes to get certain lawsuits thrown out. But this is something that he has to do, and that's part of the managing for the long term.
Because the whole idea is, let's not go through all of this and, fix the $18 billion in long-term liabilities, get that restructured, and then he leaves, and here we go all over again.
I think that's exactly right, and you know, there's a lot of doubt and skepticism on the part of players in the municipal finance market that Detroit can, in fact, fix its culture and fix its dysfunction. I think it's a very cynical approach, personally. I mean, it's akin to what we saw with the auto bankruptcies, where, or even in Ford's case, where they did not go through bankruptcy, but they financed their own restructuring, and here we are on the other side of it, and these companies are run differently. They look different. They've got fewer brands. They've also got fewer employees and fewer plants. But they are executing in a much more consistent fashion than they did before the implosion.
Well, you write some interesting points here, Daniel Howes. The effort will prove controversial. It likely would be considered an affront to yet another tradition of self-government in a city whose elected city council and mayor are now secondary to the decision-making of a Washington bankruptcy lawyer appointed by Governor Rick Snyder. So what does this mean, in your view, for the democratic system of government?
Well, I think they're sensitive, when I say they, the emergency manager's team and the governor's office, they're sensitive to appearing to bigfoot this and essentially unilaterally try to change the charter, and it's not at all clear that they can even do that. But I think they are trying to be realistic here and say there are barriers to reform in Detroit. The charter is one aspect of that. It militates against, for example, being able to privatize certain kinds of services. I don't think there's any doubt that when we get on the other side of this bankruptcy, there are going to be services offered to the Detroiters that will not be offered by employees and provided by employees of the city. So as a practical matter, I think they're raising some legitimate points. Now, anything that is perceived to come from the governor or Kevin Orr is going to be, I think, greeted by some measure, with some measure of hostility and resistance. But it's very important to recognize this as a legal matter. The city of Detroit is a creation of the state of Michigan. It's not a sovereign city. It's a creation of the state. The state is sovereign, but it's not. The city is not. And, you know, the governor, I think, is within his purview to at least raise some of these questions, because at the end of the day, the state does have some responsibility for what happens in Detroit, and that's why he's doing what he's doing. But these are, as they've pointed out to me, recommendations. The governor in an interview said, you know, this is about preventing things from rolling back down the hill, was the metaphor that he used. And that is, we're going to make progress here, and we don't want to finish this job and then all of a sudden be back in the same situation 10 years from now.
Daniel, for especially for listeners who are not Detroiters and perhaps haven't been kept up to speed on how it's governed, talk some more about this charter and changes that you think need to be made in it.
Well, I think one of the things is, I understand the charter, and I haven't read it line by line, but as I understand it, it has, for example, protections and of the union workforce, and that certain services cannot, and most services cannot be privatized. We had a situation where, or the city had a situation where its attorney, the corporation counsel, could not be fired by the mayor. Part of this is a legacy of the Kwame Kilpatrick years. I think some of the restrictions that were put into the charter when it was revised a couple of years ago were a reaction to what Mayor Kilpatrick was doing and the way he was running roughshod over the checks and balances within the system. So what I think you see here is the classic case of overcorrecting. We saw in the situation of Mike Duggan running for mayor and then being disqualified because it said that a candidate had to live in the city for 1 year. Well, does that mean that if a candidate lived in the city for 1 year and 3 days that they couldn't run for mayor either? So there's a lot of wording and things that could be construed to block change, essentially. And in one case, it was used against Mike Duggan. In another case, it was used to keep Crystal Crittenden in the office of Corporation Counsel long after it became clear that the person that was essentially running the city of Detroit, at least from a policy perspective, was the corporation council, and she was not answerable to the mayor or to a majority of council. They'd have to have six members vote to oust her before she could be fired.
Where do you expect the most pushback to come from as Orr tries to make Detroit City Hall work better and tries to lay the groundwork for the future?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the most pushback is going to probably come from organized labor. You know, the salaried ranks don't have the same kind of clout in a situation like this. But it's important to note that Chapter 9 bankruptcy gives the court and the debtor, who in this case would be Kevin Orr, an enormous amount of power to invalidate contracts and make changes. So I think you're going to have general pushback, but I think what people are going to be surprised by, my guess is the speed with which all this is going to happen. It's very important. We're used to watching Detroit government move very slowly, take one or two steps forward and a couple steps back. What we have now under this emergency manager law, and now in Chapter 9, is a group of professionals hired to do a job. You've got Kevin Orr, who was brought in as the manager. You have restructuring experts, accounting firms, lawyers, they're all professionals.
New chief financial officer.
These people are not running for office. They're not looking towards the next primary. They're not looking at the next general election. They're not eyeing, as a general proposition, running for mayor at any time in the future. They've been brought in to do a job, and they're technicians, and I think, and they have the power of the court now that they can put things before the court and have the judge rule upon them. And I think from what we hear of Judge Stephen Rhodes, he's a hard-nosed judge. He's a no-nonsense guy, and he's decisive. He doesn't wish a wash around. He's also been a guy who has been very outspoken at the fact that some of the biggest bankruptcies in Southeast Michigan have not been adjudicated in Detroit. General Motors, Chrysler, Kmart, Delphi, they've all been done in New York or outside of the Eastern District of Michigan. And he now is presiding over probably one of the biggest bankruptcies ever in Southeast Michigan, certainly from a historic perspective. And I think he's going to take that duty very seriously from what I've seen of some of the filings already.
Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes, as always, a pleasure talking with you. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
A federal judge has stopped any lawsuits attempting to derail the Detroit bankruptcy. Federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes today says all the issues related to Detroit's bankruptcy must be decided by the federal bankruptcy court exclusively. His ruling puts an end to any challenges arising from state courts, and that includes a case filed in Ingham County by lawyers representing Detroit pensioners. Those retirees say their pensions are protected by the Michigan Constitution and cannot be cut by a bankruptcy court. That issue will now have to be decided by Judge Rhodes. Be sure to tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock, and that's when you can catch a special documentary by Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity team. They're going to explore the role of men in the lives of children. That's at this time tomorrow afternoon. Still to come, dysfunctional government is not the only thing plaguing Detroit. The city's crime rate is one of the highest in the nation. How can you really fix a city when there's so much violence? That conversation comes up next. And then it's been 3 years since the Enbridge Energy oil spill in the Kalamazoo River. We'll get an update on the cleanup coming up in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With the historic Detroit bankruptcy filing, there has been plenty of talk about money, taxes, about shrinking revenue, rising legacy costs. But my next two guests strongly believe all of those dollar-based conversations overlook one of the biggest reasons that people leave Detroit and why they don't want to come back and live in Detroit. And that reason is crime. According to emergency manager Kevin Orr's report to the city's creditors, Detroit's violent crime rate is 5 times the national average, and it takes Detroit police an average of 58 minutes to respond to a call, where the national average is 11 minutes. Those harsh realities are just the tip of the iceberg. Let's talk more about how these chronic, stubbornly high levels of crime affect Detroit's recovery and what can be done going forward to make Detroit a safer place to live and work. Joining me now is Carl Taylor, professor of sociology at Michigan State University.
Thank you.
And the former deputy editorial page director for the Detroit News, Jeff Haddon, in the studio with me. Hello, Jeff.
Hi.
I want to start with your thoughts, Carl, with all the talk about what is wrong with Detroit as the bankruptcy filing has happened. Is the persistently high crime rate being talked about enough in your view?
No, it's not. Not even remotely. Because you have to talk about poverty and a lot of other complex issues that are not being talked about. Everything is focusing on money and pension, and that certainly is very, very important. And that also has a direct impact on crime because you're talking about public safety. So you're talking about the firefighters and the policemen. So I think there needs to be a lot more focus on crime.
And Jeff, as someone who's been, you know, decades in journalism, what's your view on why crime has not figured in the conversation as much?
Because I think it's like background noise that after you hear it long enough, it fades into the background. You don't. So we have had a constant drumbeat for years and years of years of 325, 340 homicides per year, a higher than average crime rate. And people just get inured to it. But it tears the fabric of neighborhoods. It tears away the livability of the city. It affects everybody at a level of sort of a existential level. I mean, am I going to be hurt today? Is my child going to be hurt today? Is it safe for them to go to school? This is not something that's conducive to revitalizing a city.
Carl Taylor, you wrote a guest opinion piece for the Detroit Free Press talking about what you described as urban terrorism. Tell us, what did you mean by that, and give us a sense of what it's like day to day for citizens and for neighborhoods?
Well, I caught a lot of heat for that, using that term terrorism, both from the academy and also from some in the community. I'm a native of Detroit. Grew up in Detroit, and I'm a product of Detroit public schools. I received a very good education, and I lived in Detroit. I grew up in right up until the riot. That's when I went away to college. I'm talking about being able to function as a normal person, a human being that can take their kids to school, kids can walk to school without being harmed. I'm talking about the intimidation that goes on many times, the fear, and it's like two different worlds, what I grew up in Detroit and what exists today. So you're speaking of abandoned houses, but far more important, I'm looking at the attitude of those who are transgressors. But I do have to underscore, as I was chastised, and rightfully so, that I'm not talking about the thousands of decent Americans who are working very hard in Detroit. So I don't want to give one size fits all. But crime is extreme in many areas in the neighborhoods and in Detroit. So we have to address that. So you're just afraid. You cannot have a quality of life that I had as a young man coming up in Detroit.
And talk about the attitude of the transgressors, because you kind of seize on that. Your view, what is it and where does it stem from?
Well, that's a great question. I think one that we should walk very slowly with.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the transgressors, we have issues of dysfunctional families to the extreme that we were warned about earlier from people like Daniel Monahan and others. We have a large, I think, segment that are suffering from mental health issues that no one wants to talk about. You cannot close down the facilities and remove the type of support that you need for mental health without having the backlash that we are seeing now. And then we have some that are dedicated to crime. They see crime is an institution that if they can't fulfill their dreams in the traditional avenues, and employment is one of those big avenues, then they feel that crime is a paying institution, and it is to a large degree. So I think those are the variables, but I walk very cautiously as I point those out.
Mm-hmm.
We look at unemployment as unbelievable. When I was a young boy coming up in Detroit as a teenager, I had a choice of jobs, a lot of employment. So that I went to Roosevelt, Durfee, and Central. So I walk very gingerly, I have to say that, because if you don't, and I think it only further divides the community and makes it ugly.
And Jeff, I know you're a born and bred Detroiter, and has you too have the perspective of many decades. So, what would you like to add to this?
I totally agree with what Carl says about it hurting the fabric of the neighborhoods, and about sort of the family dysfunction and family breakdown on the part of many in Detroit. And I agree with Carl. You don't want to use too broad a brush here, because there are hardworking.
Mm-hmm.
Moms who are doing the best they can by their kids. I worked at the paper, the Detroit News, for years with products of single families who their mother beat their brains out. They went to Wayne. They're productive, hardworking folks, and that's fine. The Michigan Citizens Research Council did a study and said that Detroit has the highest percentage of single female headed households of any major city in the country. I think the general agreement is that if you have young men who don't have a man in their life, doesn't have to be a father, but it could be a minister, it could be an uncle, it could be an older brother, somebody looking out for him, somebody making sure that he's growing up with the right attitudes,
mm-hmm.
you are going to have a problem with that young man. Of any race. There's a British psychiatrist named Anthony Daniels who writes under the nom de plume Theodore Dalrymple, who's done similar studies of family dysfunction in northern British cities like Manchester or Scottish cities, mm-hmm. like Glasgow. They're big industrial centers. They have the same kind of issues at Detroit. You have the same kind of family breakdown. You have the same issue. So it's not a racial thing. It's a sociological thing.
And how in the world do you put that back together as you are trying to put Detroit back together?
Well, you have to. We're not addressing that at all. And I'm glad to hear him say in relation that it's a problem. And it has been. But I think we have to be careful, again, in relation to single-headed female households. I was it's my brother Virgil and I. We were raised by my parents until my dad passed and I was 13 in Detroit. But my father, my parents, the structure was there, the law was there. And so, for example, if we were going off track, my mother only had to say, you can stand up and be a man like your father expects you to be. She ruled and the discipline was there, but the discipline and the standard was there in the community of Northwest Detroit, where I grew up, that the Taylor boys belonged to the community. So if you saw us doing something wrong, you could do whatever, including, you know, you could let us have it physically. And we would pray to God that you wouldn't call, you know, my parents. But I think a lot of female households have raised and produced very strong sons. This is nothing new as a phenomenal social phenomenon in America. You have Irish and Italians and Jewish and a lot of single-headed female households. The difference is the attitudes that we're seeing now from parents, whether they're single or two-headed households. And I'm seeing in Detroit and in other communities, but in particular in Detroit, a lot of parents that support behavior and attitudes that leads to a lot of problems. That's just a total disrespect and a disconnect from authority. So it's not simply that they're not going along with what the teachers say. They don't respect anything. And that's something that is, to me, in my research, and my research parallels others, what we're seeing in terms of statistics, but I'm seeing something quite different and have been for the last three decades. I've seen an erosion of parental guidance and authority. And so, for example, a lot of times the parents are supporting their children, and in particular young men, in this behavior that we are not addressing. And it's, so it's internal and it's external. And I think we better follow that right away.
That was Carl Taylor. He's a professor of sociology at Michigan State University. And also we're speaking with Jeff Haddon, who's the former deputy editorial page director for the Detroit News. And Jeff joins us in the studio. And someone touched on that issue of greater divisions. And this is certainly something that you tread lightly as you discuss, because it's so easy to have non-Detroiters say, well, see, that's them. And here's something one of our coworkers overheard this few days ago on a flight back to Detroit. She overheard a fellow passenger as they were talking about the bankruptcy. And the quote was, I wish we could just dump Detroit into the lake. We'd all be better off. Do either of you think sentiments like that stem from the crime headlines more than the financial headlines? Jeff, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it does. It's I think the crime issue is a sort of unspoken subtext of a lot of conversations about Detroit. I agree with Professor Taylor that you don't want to paint too broad a brush.
Right.
You don't want to single out any one group of folks. I mentioned that you have the same phenomenon in Northern Britain with family dysfunction, so it's not racial. I think that, as I said in my column, there are certain things that government alone can't do. And Carl talked about it, about the cohesive family neighborhood, whether it's Irish, whether it's Italian, whether it's Polish, whether it's African-American. One of the most powerful groups in the city is the Black Baptist pastors. They have a lot of political clout and a lot of social clout. And some pastors have devoted themselves to having religious schools, after-school programs, community outreach. And that's the kind of thing that Detroit needs more of, more informal, what Edmund Burke called the little platoons of society, the social network, the family, the neighborhood, the if you're a Protestant, the congregation. Mm-hmm. If you're a Catholic, it's the parish. Mm-hmm. You have to have the men in the neighborhood watching out for the boys. You have to have the moms watching out for the girls. You have to have everybody watching out for everybody.
Just like Carl said he grew
exactly,
up with. Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to take us looking forward, because that's certainly something that Kevin Orr is trying to do as he does the debt restructuring. He's also trying to put groundwork in effect to look forward. What happens when Detroit is out of bankruptcy, when Kevin Orr is gone, and here Detroiters are left to run their city? What do each of you believe are the most crucial and the most financially viable ways to tackle crime in Detroit? And I guess we're talking about what you think police could do, city officials could do, and the people of Detroit. Carl, I'd like to start with you.
Well, I'm completing a new, I did a study on a new book, which I called The Third City, and I have three core areas that you have to readdress in a different way. We're talking about dysfunctional families. We really have to address families. But I think we have to be careful not to choke on nostalgia. That includes myself. I think that you cannot prescribe necessarily one size that fits all. That one of our problems is that we look at, there's a certain group in the community that has been rejected by everyone and everything. When I hear him speak of a faith-based institution, he is correct. However, we have a lot of children. In the studies that I have been doing since the 80s, a lot of children are not in anybody's church. We have a lot of children who are not in school, so therefore they cannot drop out of school. And so we really have to attack this in a new way, in a way that I think many of us are not really capable of doing in our first thought. You talk about those people. We have black people saying those people at times. It becomes a class issue. And then, of course, job training and employment. Those are the areas that we must go to, and we, you know, it sounds like the same song, but it's really not. A lot of these young men and women are not ready to go to work if they had the job. Their socialization has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed correctly. We will not be able to beat this up or lock it up or kill it. I'm serious. So I think that we have to address this in a different manner in which we have before. I've heard things about the police, and Detroit is not the only community. I think that the poor part of America is really revolting in a way that people don't understand, and they think they don't care. But as we're finding out in Michigan, so you can say Detroit can drop off in the river, but it's going to cost the state of Michigan and America a lot of money. It would make more sense to invest in education. This destruction of public education bothers me deeply because many of the schools, charter schools with all due respect, we keep leaving the same people out. And that population has grown immensely, whether you like it or not. It's those who are outside and are not allowed to participate, they're the ones who are feeding the criminal population. And we haven't quite understood that. Our politicians don't get it. Law enforcement is still grappling with it. We're spending more money on prison. So those are the three areas that I would look at.
Well, I would simply say that as far as charter schools or alternative schools, if parents are interested enough to try to get their kids into a charter school or a school of choice, they ought to have that option. If they're not, then it falls to the public schools to try to be more proactive, to have teachers understand that theirs is not a 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. job, to stick with the kids, to tutor them, to follow their studies. And that's going to put more weight on the public schools. And that's something that they haven't been doing very well in the past. And they may have to step up and do that because Carl's right. The students who are excluded from opportunities are the ones who are fed into the crime. The city has cut the police from something like 4,000 to 2,700.
Right.
Uniformed officers are down from 3,000 in 2002 last year to 2,000. So in that 10 years, you've lost a third of your uniformed officers. And more are scheduled to retire this year and next year. So whatever the other city priorities are, you have to do the ground level basics, which is have enough police available to respond to crime in a timely way. You have to have enough staffing. You have to have enough emphasis on a functioning department. That's the first thing you do. Then you have all the social issues that Carl and I have been talking about, and you can argue about which is best and which isn't, what works and what doesn't. However that is resolved, it's got to be addressed too, because you've got to stop the pipeline, and once they're in the pipeline, you've got to give them a deterrent. And if you don't do that, life for the vast majority of people in Detroit who are law-abiding and trying to make a life for themselves is, as Carl says, it's just unlivable.
Sadly, we're going to have to leave it there, but we would like to get you both back on to continue the conversation because it's great getting your insights, and we really appreciate both of you talking with us today. We've been speaking with Carl Taylor, professor of sociology at Michigan State University, and the former deputy editorial page director for the Detroit News, Jeff Haddon. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Still to come, this week marks the third anniversary of the Enbridge oil spill into the Kalamazoo River. We'll get an update on the cleanup. And then Michigan singer-storyteller Allison Downey brings us the voices from a Michigan summer carnival. That's in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week marks 3 years since an Enbridge energy pipeline ruptured near Marshall, spilling nearly 800,000 gallons of tar sands oil into Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River. The cleanup has already cost Enbridge almost $1 billion, and they still have lots of work ahead of them. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith's been following this story all along, and she joins us now from Muskegon. Lindsay, so it has been 3 years. How is the cleanup going? What's the latest?
Well, I will say a lot of things have improved. I took a little canoe trip down the river recently, and I think the last time I was there was 2 summers ago, so 1 year after the oil spill. And you can immediately tell the difference that you can't see really any oil. You have to really dig for it. And most of the oil that's left is really on the river bottom. And that's where the rest of the cleanup will be. The EPA has ordered Enbridge to do some dredging of the Kalamazoo River. They hope to get about 12,000 gallons of submerged oil that's still on the river bottom. But there will be some that's left there. It'll get slowly picked up through these sediment traps. But some of it is likely to stay there, you know, in perpetuity.
So there really is no way to really get that water cleaned up totally.
Well, it comes down to whether or not you're going to cause more harm than it's worth. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good analogy, but if you really dig up a bunch of stuff just to get a little bit of oil, I mean, you can really destroy a lot more habitat for fish, wildlife. Getting in heavy machinery in by a riverbank is not exactly ideal for the habitat there. So that's what it comes down to, yeah.
Earlier this week, Lindsay, 11 people were arrested during a protest in Ingham County. What was that about? What happened?
Well, this is a group, a coalition in Michigan, but I would also say, I would venture to say, it's part of a larger push of activists that are against tar sand oil, the development in Alberta, Canada mainly, in that the pipeline that Enbridge is building to replace the one that ruptured. It's going to be a little bit bigger, so it'll be able to ship more. They say there's, you know, higher demand at refineries, so they need to just, you know, take care of their customers. So they're expanding and replacing this old pipeline with this new one. The people who are opposed to developing tar sands oil in general, some of them have become more aggressive, I would say, in their protests, and that they're willing to get arrested and civil disobedience to kind of make their point.
So what is next for Enbridge and for the people who live near the pipeline?
Well, Enbridge, you know, if you talk to them, they're there till the end. I mean, they're replacing the current pipeline. They expect to be in these communities for an extended period of time. I've been to their headquarters in Marshall. It's a very seemingly permanent place. And as far as what's next for them, they, you know, they really have to follow the EPA's orders to be able to finish this kind of cleanup, which really has no end in sight as far as having a definite end. Just talking to the EPA, eventually they'll hand it over to the state's Department of Environmental Quality to take care of this stuff, the rest of the cleanup once the EPA is done with it. But even then, Enbridge will have to satisfy the state if the state has any further requirements for drinking water or any other problems that may come up.
And what's the timetable for completing the repairs and having that pipeline intact from Sarnia, Ontario, to Griffith, Indiana?
Well, they want to have that replacement pipe finished by the end of this year.
And for people who live between Sarnia and Griffith, Indiana, for the people who have to live near that pipeline, what are they saying about all of this?
Well, I mean, it's still very controversial. At this point, there are, from what I understand, there are still some holdouts for land leases and land rights. But you know, Enbridge really has been moving all right along. I mean, you can go to places where it's under construction, where these people got arrested in Mason earlier this week. So, you know, it's definitely happening. The people that are living near the pipeline are have dealt with it and will probably continue to deal with its existence, it seems.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith has been following the Enbridge story, and you can hear more on the Environment Report. That's tomorrow during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks, Cindy.
In other environmental news, we turn now to dioxins. You know, it's hard to think of an example when that word is used in anything but in a negative context. These environmental pollutants are known to be toxic to many animal species, and since dioxins work their way up the food chain to humans, there needs to be a clearer understanding of their effects on humans. That's why we wanted you to know about a more than $14 million five-year study that's being launched at Michigan State University. Researchers are hoping to get a clearer idea how dioxins affect human health and to figure out new ways to remove them from the environment. Norbert Kaminsky directs Michigan State University's Center for Integrative Toxicology. He's the lead researcher in this study, and he joins us from the campus in East Lansing. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, considering the dark headlines that always seem to accompany any story about dioxins, I think most of us would be very surprised to hear that in your study, you're going to try to better understand how dioxins affect human health. So does that mean we don't really know for sure?
Well, what we do know is that in spite of probably over 40 years now of research on dioxins, most of that research has been done in laboratory animals. And more recent advances in technology and the biological sciences now allows us to conduct some of our studies using human cells and human tissues so that we can have a better understanding of the effects that dioxins have actually in humans. One of the things that we do know is that the effects of dioxins in animal species is actually very diverse. So some animal species are extremely sensitive to dioxins and the toxic effects it produces, whereas other animal species seem to be rather refractory or not very sensitive. And so what we really don't still have a clear understanding of is where humans fall on that continuum.
And this is a way now, because the technology is available, for you to be able to examine the effect on humans without endangering anyone's health.
That's correct. So, for example, one of the projects will focus on the effects of dioxins on the human immune system. So we're able to actually collect white blood cells from healthy donors and actually add dioxin to those cells as they're cultured and then measure the effects of those dioxins on the way those cells function. So that's just one example.
Norbert, give us an idea when you talk about the fact that there's a continuum of effects on animal species. When you see species that are very sensitive to dioxins, what kinds of problems result from that?
Yeah. Well, for example, the guinea pig, which is the most sensitive animal species that we know of in terms of dioxin and dioxin-like compounds, dioxins actually can cause a wasting syndrome that leads to death of the animal, whereas at the other end of that continuum, it might sound funny, is the hamster, which seems to be rather refractory toward the effects of dioxins. So the hamster can sustain relatively high doses of dioxins and does not, for example, develop a wasting syndrome, which leads to death.
And in your research project at Michigan State University, it's a big $14.1 million project. You're also trying to figure out new ways of removing dioxins from the environment. What are the shortcomings of the current ways of cleaning up dioxins, and what needs to be fixed?
Well, probably one of the biggest challenges is the cost of remediation currently, how it's done. Typically, you know, soil or sediment that's been contaminated is removed and then either moved to a waste facility or perhaps incinerated. One of the areas that we're investigating is the ability of naturally occurring microorganisms to actually be able to degrade and break down dioxins. And if we're able to identify those microorganisms, you can imagine that they, for example, could be used in at least in part for the remediation process.
Now, with the EPA is proposing a plan to stabilize and clean up the dioxin-contaminated sediment and riverbanks in segment 2 of the Tittabawassee River. So that's that 4-mile stretch of the river below the Dow Chemical plant in Midland. In fact, they're now taking public comments on the cleanup. Give us a sense how bad the dioxin contamination of the Tittabawassee Basin is, and also other areas in Michigan that are on the dioxin watch list.
From some of the sampling that the EPA has done along the Tittabawassee, what we know is that there are what one might call hot spots. So there are certain areas that the EPA has identified that have relatively high concentrations of dioxin and dioxin-like compounds in the sediment of that river. And it's quite varied, as you, or at least as the EPA has done that type of sampling. So, again, this represents a huge challenge, both in terms of the financial costs associated with this cleanup, as well as, you know, what it may do to the natural wildlife and ecosystem that surrounds that beautiful river. So these are challenges which the EPA and the community are wrestling with right now.
And if you and I are talking 5 years down the road, what are your hopes for what we'll be talking about that you and the team accomplished after the 5 years and the more than $14 million?
So in addition to having a better understanding of the actual mechanisms by which toxicity occur and having a better understanding of how we might be able to do cleanup, I think the other very important outcome from this type of work is providing better information to our regulators and policymakers so that they can actually make the science-based determinations in terms of what level of cleanup is necessary to make sure that people are safe. So you can imagine that it probably is not impossible to take every last bit of dioxin or dioxin-like compounds from that sediment. But the question is, at what cost, and do we really need to do that? And so we're hoping to better inform these regulators as to what level of a cleanup is actually necessary to make sure people are safe.
Norbert Kaminsky directs Michigan State University's Center for Integrative Toxicology. He is the lead researcher in a new major study that will be done over the next 5 years, looking at how dioxins affect human health and figuring out new ways of removing them from the environment. And he joined us from East Lansing. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Everybody's got a story. Some are very extraordinary stories. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs.
Because a story is the shortest distance between two people.
The Living Room is our ongoing storytelling series hosted by Allison Downey.
4th of July weekend, I took my son to the Battle Creek Air Show and Carnival.
What's your favorite ride?
The bumper car.
And I got curious about the lure of this American carnival tradition and decided to talk to some of the people who devote their lives to it.
Come on, sir, don't be shy. Come on, let them give it a try.
There are three kinds of people. The ones that are born into it, like myself, we are called Carney Brats. My name is David Chase Heston Sanders. The fun kind of stopped for me when I was like 7. You know, I got to meet new friends, say goodbye to my friends. I never see friends again. I'm 15, and, you know, all my friends are like 30 and 29. Other guys are 60. Some people want to join the carnival because they have an idea, a sort of sense of adventure.
Well, I was young and I got into some trouble, and my friend worked out here, and so I went with him one day and I met a girl and she became like best friends, and then I've just been traveling ever since then. So,
some people, they got a good life, they got a good job, they got a wife.
I was making $150,000 a year.
Something happens, it just falls apart, they come out here.
She stole my heart. She stepped on it, spit on me, and then I joined the carnival. My name's Dawson. I sell sandwiches, and I dropped one on the ground, and I sold it for $4. And now my nickname's Dirty D. That was like 15 years ago.
Most of the people I've talked to, they've wanted to be out here. They love it. There's no other job like it.
Actually, to tell you the honest truth about me, this is really all I know. I never got a real job in the real world. I grew up, I was poor. My parents, you know, said, get a job, kid. And I bothered the guy at the carnival, in the local carnival, and gave me a job, and my mom signed me away.
How old were you?
I was 12. My name is Freddie Maloney. They call me the Freak Show because I used to have a lot of body piercings and tattoos. I mean, you can ask the ladies why they call me that, but...
Alrighty, moving right along.
This is my last year out here, though. I'm here with my fiancé. I've been doing it for about 4 years. I'm 20. He's 21, and my daughter, she's 7 months. So we're going to do this fair season and get some money and go home and put a down payment on a place.
Three games for $1, guys. Come on, the family that plays together stays together.
I work ping pong joint and throw ping pong ball into a fish bowl. Only have one prize. It's a fish. It's a perfect shot for the perfect prize, I tell them. And they look at me like, perfect prize, it's a fish. I'll be like, yeah, but God made it. He don't make ugly. That gets them, too. They'll be like, okay, let's play. That's how you do it.
Come on, one more time. You're getting close, son. You're close. You're right on the money.
Got to have a gift of gab. If you don't have a gift of gab, it's not going to work out there on the midway.
You're throwing against the wind. Oh! Pinging and ponging.
My name's John Ushman. You can call me Carney. I'll turn around. Sometimes I refer to myself as a carny because that's what I am. It goes back to my child dying. It's all based on that part of it. When she died of SIDS, something in me died, and I just went soul searching, and I found it here in this life, and it's really all I want to do. And you know, it took a while. You know, drug abuse and everything. It takes a long time. I'm still healing from it. I fight that every day. I'm clean to this day. I've been clean for almost 5 years. I feel great. I don't sell drugs no more. I sell teddy bears. There's a longer lifespan. I see my little girl in the kids that I play. It's... I just really don't have any other words for it. You know, I just see her. Stand up there. That helped me get over it.
You know? Give me a few extra balls. All right, let's start this game over.
Life in the carnival business is not always a cup of tea, but I'll tell you what, when you do get that cup of tea, it's real sweet. I do like what I like what I do.
Toss it into the play area. Hopefully you get it in.
And holding on to time gone is kind of like trying to catch a song in midair when you don't believe that it's out there. So let go of time gone. What's your name? It's been so long. Just clean the slate and take me to the fair. Yes, clean the slate and take me to the fair. Oh, now clean the slate and take me. Take me.
The Living Room is produced by Allison Downey and Zach Rosen. To see pictures of some of the carnival workers we heard from, just go to our website, michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Mercedes Mejia, and engineer was Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside.